offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, this is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, with me, his brother Arvind. It's another very beautiful festive season at Prashanthi Nilayam. We just completed wonderful Christmas celebrations. As always, it comes in with a different flavor altogether, and it's always a joy to be here at Prashanthi Nilayam any time of the year, especially when we have such beautiful festivals. Christmas is one such festival, and we are looking forward to the other festival, the New Year Day, which is coming, which also marks the homecoming of all the alumni who will be joining us here at Prashanthi Nilayam. You must have heard the program before this. Bishu must have spoken to you about the Prema Bandha meet, which is going to happen this weekend, where all the school and university alumni will be coming. But the week that we just left behind was that of Christmas. We had devotees from New Zealand this time decorating the entire ashram. Of course, the devotees from South Africa, as always, giving us the lighting, and the rest of the overseas devotees joining in with the carol singing and the decoration. It was such a very beautiful event. But now we're here to continue with our conversations with Sai, and of course, before we give you a short summary of what we covered last time and what we're going to be covering this week, I'm sure Arvind would like to add about what I spoke about Christmas and events coming. So let's invite Arvind. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem. And rightly, you know, I definitely want to add a few words about the Christmas celebrations from a different perspective. You know, we have always seen Christmas as Swami's students or like Swami's staff members, permanent residents at Prashanthi Nilayam. This time I experienced it in a different light, like a father, you know, because it was such a wonderful thrill, because now my daughter has reached an age where she asks questions and is curious to know, and it becomes so difficult to explain Christmas till you enter Prashanthi Nilayam. You know, Prashanthi Nilayam made Christmas available to the eyes, to the ears, to the nose, to the tongue, because it was not just restricted to the lights and sounds. There was awesome and fantastic feasts and treats available at the Western Canteen, and it was so beautiful. It was such a wholesome experience, and I'm really grateful to all the devotees from across the globe who not only, you know, bring out the true spirit of Christmas, they do it for every festival. You know, different states come with different festivals, and I don't think there's any place like this on earth where you see such a harmonious blend and such a wide variety of festivals that span cultures, that span religions, that span every kind of so-called difference that man has made. And it is so beautiful that we get to experience it. And as I said, as a father this time, I saw how wonderfully easy it becomes, rather than us trying to explain to the child. Just let the child walk into Prashanthi Nilayam, get amazed by the lights that were there everywhere, and especially concentrated around the lawns near the Western Canteen. Every evening it was a carnival there, Prem, because every evening for the last 3 days I have been visiting the lawns of the Western Canteen, not the Western Canteen actually, because I think there were two sets of people coming there, you know, one set to go to the Western Canteen, one set to come to the lawns of the Western Canteen. Of course, there was some kind of overlap as well. People would go both places, but the lawns was a hub of activity, and children, you can see children of all colors, children of all sizes, children just playing together, and I felt that they brought out the spirit of Christmas so beautifully, because it showed that love is beyond all kinds of barriers. There were children who couldn't communicate with each other because one possibly spoke Korean, one possibly spoke Spanish, and the other was a Telugu speaking child, and my child was there with a smattering of Kannada and Marathi, and yet in their own cautious way they're getting together, going around those lights. It was so beautiful, it was so uplifting for me, and I felt that is where the spirit of Christmas got captured. And so on my personal front, as well as from so many other parents in Prashantinilayam, as well as all the devotees in Prashantinilayam, I think we need to extend our heartfelt gratitude to the devotees who not only put up such fantastic programs and decorations in the Mandir, Kulwant Hall, but also all around Prashantinilayam. And it is this, Swami would often say, Deshamante Mattikadu, Deshamante Manishuloi, meaning a country doesn't mean the mud in the country. A country means the people. It is the people that make up the country. In the same way, Prashantinilayam is not just the buildings, the brick and mortar of this place, but the feelings and the divinity that people embody and bring into this place. And for that, we are all grateful to Swami.
Just to sum up everything that is to be said about Christmas in Prashanti, you know, we just had an article on Christmas Day. It was a conversation with one of the old late devotees from Canada. Mm-hmm. And she puts it in one sentence, and I think it cannot be said better. Because she came to Swami, I think, when she was 60 or maybe older than that, brought up in a Christian family and very, very devout Christian. In fact, a minister in a church. And when asked, what does Christmas mean to you? What was the first Christmas like? And she said, I mean, the words she used were so beautiful. She said, you know, it's like the smell of jasmine. It was like, you know, the fresh spring flowers, all those words.
Grandma Joyce, right?
Yes. Yeah. At the end of it, she said so beautifully, she said, Christmas in Prashantinilayam put Christ back into Christmas. He says, because that's the only thing which is missing. Celebrations are there. Lot of eating is there. Revelry is there. Festivities are there. But Christ is missing in Christmas, and that's what Swami did. He put Christ back into Christmas.
You know, when you say that, it just strikes me that without Christ, it's only a mass.
Right.
We may have masses everywhere, you know, for the occasion of Christmas, but it's only Christ who makes it Christmas.
Right. And that's what Christmas is, and that's what every festival is. And, you know, talking about the new year, that's what Swami would say, that this is a year which, I mean, this is a time of the year. It's nothing. Years come and go. Every minute is new. Every second is new. But you celebrate a new year so that you take stock of life. You see, what have you done? What have you achieved? Have you spent your life well? Have you turned more rigorously and religiously towards God? That's what Swami does. You know, every festival he ensures that the spirit of that festival is celebrated, and that's what we are fortunate to, as you beautifully said, without doing away with the festivities, the color, the joy, and the food and all that. Everything is included, and that's the beauty. Coming back to what we're going to be discussing today, as dear listeners, we took a couple of weeks to discuss about a message that Swami gives, a very, very beautiful message. The acronym watch your words, actions, thoughts, character, and heart. Now it's time to go back to the satsang we do on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, where Dr. Hislop has recorded his conversations with Swami, those which were direct conversations between him and Swami, and those that he was fortunate to witness. And we are going through that. This is, I think, the 15th episode of that particular series. One thing is, we can understand a lot of things which Swami says in his discourses in a deeper way, because Swami is explaining it with a very personal touch. That is one strain of this conversation. The other thing is, as an observer, what Hislop is noticing, that Swami is performing acts and how he is conversing with people, what he is doing, why he does some things, I think that also is brought out very beautifully in these conversations, and that is what we're fortunate to go through. To give you a brief about what we had last week, maybe not the whole thing, but towards the end we had this one visitor asking this question about the idea of illusion. You know, he speaks about, you know, I see Hislop sitting in front of me, but what I see is not Hislop, but an image of Hislop which is formed in my mind. And then from there, the discussion about delusion, and then he speaks about the experience of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, and he says, Swami, I've had the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, but you know, now I'm getting back to my work and that seems to be lost, so how do I retain it? And Swami says that he gives a beautiful example, the purity of the water which is there when it rains
in the clouds
will never be found once the water comes down to the earth. How much ever you purify it, it'll never go back to its purity. And Swami says that as long as you are in this body, as long as you're involved with your duties around you, there will be that difference between that pure state and now, and that needs to be accepted. But you carry on with your duty. Don't do your duty, be it your office work or your duties towards your family, for their sake, but do it for God. And whatever you do, do it perfectly and make it as an offering to God. And that is the way you can ensure that from this state of being as, you know, a droplet on earth, you return to that state of being a pure droplet in the cloud. And that is the way, that's where I think we concluded last week's discussion.
And I think that is possibly where even that particular interview concluded, because when we go to the next part, something totally new begins. It's a different scenario and a very interesting one at that. Hislop writes, a group of farmers from whom Swami had purchased a parcel of land adjoining the college came with a bag to carry away the purchase money. So Swami was buying land for the expansion of the college. In fact, if we see today, we have something called the Vidyagiri Road. Right from the General Hospital till the Gokulam. That entire stretch of road, interestingly, I got to know, I don't know, I think mostly I am right. It is actually a private road that belongs to Bhagwan and the university, but Bhagwan has been kind enough to allow vehicles to ply on that road. Otherwise, it actually is a private road because the entire land on either side belongs to Swami. So it makes common sense that even this land belonged to Swami, just that a road has been made for convenience and which has been allowed to be used by everybody. So if we start off from the General Hospital, we have the primary school on one side, then the primary school, then the gymnasium, then the higher secondary school, then the Ishwarama school and the university hostel. And on the other side, you have the university, the library, the Sai Geeta's mausoleum, the planetarium, the indoor stadium. So the entire road belongs to Swami, and Swami acquired it from farmers because these were all farming lands. So when he did it, he was paying them, and these farmers have come with that a bag to take the purchase money. And Hislop continues to write, but Swami gave them some 6 times as much money as had been agreed upon for the purchase. The larger sum was also larger in bulk and would not fit into the bag which the farmers had brought with them. The farmers could not understand why they were being given so much money. So one of the farmers says, Lord, how can we possibly eat your money? Take it back. And Swami says, no, the extra rupees are to get you started in some business. For now that the land is sold, where will you manage? Everyone should work and earn their living. Wow, you know, this is so superb. It shows something magnificent, because we have seen how Swami is so frugal when it comes to himself. I mean, he lived in a small room throughout his physical sojourn on earth, and anything that was lavished on him, he refused. I mean, even if the biggest feast is laid out before him, he takes only what is needed for that physical frame to stay. Never seen Swami overindulge or overeat or never. A person who is so strict and frugal with himself like that, when it comes to others, he's so generous, so giving. It's amazing and so thrilling, and we are grateful to Hislop for having recorded this, that Swami is paying 6 times the amount for the land that he's picking up from the farmers. I don't think we will ever come across an example like this, because land acquisition is a very common thing that keeps happening possibly across the world, where private land is acquired for public benefit. And when that acquisition happens, some compensation is paid to those owners of the land. Every time we hear about how the landowners are not satisfied, they demand a bigger sum and the negotiation goes on. I don't think that you need to negotiate anything over here. You know, in fact, it has come to a situation where the farmers are asking, why, Swami, why? You know, I just remember one slightly funny kind of anecdote. During the birthday season, you will see the entire Vidyagiri Road, the footpath is filled with hawkers and people selling their wares, you know. And you find everything from Ray-Ban glasses to teddy bears to, you know, I got interested in a Ray-Ban glass, and one of my friends, both of us, we wanted to buy a Ray-Ban glass. And this friend was saying that, you know, obviously, these are not originals. They will be duplicates. But just because they have stuck that Ray-Ban, that guy is going to quote 400 rupees, 500 rupees. He said, look at how I'm going to bargain. I'm going to straight away tell a price that is 1/4 of what he's telling. He will tell 400 rupees. I will tell 90 rupees, 100 rupees. That's it. that or nothing. No, that was what his strategy was. So goes to that Ray-Ban seller and he says, okay, how much is these glasses? These sunglasses? And that guy said, sir, that is 25 rupees. And you know, he just didn't, he said, oh, 25. And he ended up giving him 5 rupees more, gave him 30 and said, you keep the change. You know, I was reminded of that because that is how it is happening here. You know, the farmers are coming. It's in a reverse way. They are coming with the bags to collect money and Swami is giving them so much that they are telling Swami, we don't want to eat your money. No, Swami, why are you giving us so much? Really such a beautiful eye-opening episode.
And absolutely. In one hand, as you're saying, it speaks of Swami's magnanimity. In a sense, always. There's somebody who was selling, whenever Swami would go to Kodaikanal, the amount of money that Swami would pay the dhobi for his services during those 30 days or 3 weeks or whatever it is something which he can make, which he would probably make throughout the year. Right? And so much. And somehow, I think always dhobis, especially in, be it in Parthi, in Vrindavan or in Kodaikanal, Swami would always give them more. In fact, it's not just the dhobis. Anybody who would do all of these small works will always benefit. In fact, even when Swami used to drive from Vrindavan to Parthi, there used to be some places where beggars would come. And Swami would always give them more and, you know, he would tell the devotees around to give. See, one thing is, it is one of the greatest blessings to receive anything from Swami. And when Swami gives, it's bounty. Sometimes maybe we don't realize it. We look at it from the worldly point of view and say that this is lesser. This is not an expensive gift. Or Swami gave a gold to somebody else and this is probably just a silver. But here, I think Swami is making it clear that what he gives is always more than what you deserve. But the explanation which Swami is giving gives a completely different dimension to it. And I think that is something which we can relate to and learn in that sense. Because there's one aspect about charity which you know, the, if you could call it, Dharma Shastras usually speak about. When you do charity, the charity should not be based on how much you can give. You should never give so much so that the person who is receiving becomes lazy or, you know, chooses not to work because he's got enough money. In this case, you know, Swami is very clear. See, if you give these people just as much as the land is worth, that sum is going to be so less, they're not going to be able to do anything with that. They can only spend it till it lasts and then it's done. Right? Though the land is not worth so much, Swami is giving them so much more money so that, Swami is clearly saying, so that you can get started off in some business. So the money, that extra money which Swami is giving is not to make them lazy, but it is to make them active. To ensure that it, you know, it starts off them on something which will keep them on a sustained basis. So Swami is not looking at the value of what he is taking, but he's also thinking of how it is going to benefit the person who is receiving it. So when you're doing charity, it's not about, you know, I gave 1,000 instead of 500 rupees, or, you know, that auto driver needed only 50, but I gave him 100. That doesn't become charity. What you do should not make that person lose his morals. You should not make that person become lazy. You should not make that person give up his interest in activity. And that is precisely what Swami is telling. You know, when you do a charity, the mandate is very clear to them. Swami is saying that I'm giving you this so that you don't become inactive, so that you start something and ensure that this will take care of your livelihood. In fact, you know, one intriguing aspect of Indian culture which always has to think about is, when you look at the caste system, the highest in the caste system are the Brahmins, right? But the charity is always given to the Brahmins. In any other society, you give charity to the people who are lowest in the, you know, in the rung of society. But in Indian culture, the Brahmins are put highest, but they are the only people who are allowed to, entitled to go around asking bhiksha and receive bhiksha.
Because they are supposed to do work which does not involve remuneration.
Right, absolutely. Their work is detached from remuneration. So when you give them more remuneration, they will do more work. Because they're so much more self-sustained, they will not have to worry about, you know, what the everyday food or anything like that, and they'll do more of what they do. But suppose you have a person whose activity is linked to money, daily wage workers. So if you give that person, say, 100 rupees, he'll say, okay, 10 days I don't have to work now. On the 11th day I can go out to work. So always you look at giving a person more wealth so that, you know, he does more activity or is, you know, is made to become more active and more productive. And it's clearly what Swami is doing here.
Actually, if you see, that is what is investment versus expenditure. When you do an expenditure, you're just destroying the wealth, in a sense. And when you do an investment, it looks like an expenditure at that point in time, but it's going to come back multifold.
Right.
It's going to grow manifold. It's like eating rice grains versus sowing them in the soil. At that point in time, both look equally destructive. And possibly it looks like eating is slightly better because at least it is energizing you a little bit. It's like, yeah, he might not work for 10 days, but at least it is giving rest and leisure for one person. But when you put it in the soil, it comes back. This is Swami's example only. It comes back to you manifold. Every grain that you have put comes back as 1,000 grains. Another aspect that this episode also shows is whatever we do for Swami, it definitely comes back. Swami says that God's hand always stretches out to give. It never stretches out to receive. And even when it seems like it is receiving, we see that it's actually giving. Here, on the face of it, farmers have come to give their land to Swami, or Swami is taking the land from the farmer. Swami is receiving the land. But did Swami receive? And the amazing thing is, in the multiple opportunities that we have got, either through Radio Sai or as our own personal experience with different devotees who in quotes have given to Swami, we realize by listening to them that it was actually Swami giving them. It is just like somebody telling that farmers gave their land to Swami. It is not. It is actually Swami gave them 5 times their land price to them. Because if X is the amount that has to be paid, Swami has paid them 6X. The same is the story with all the so-called donors in the Satya Sai organization or to the Satya Sai Central Trust. When we go and speak to them, when we go and listen to their experience, we realize that though it appears as if they have given Swami, the amount that they have received from Bhagwan is always so much more that they feel humbled and at times even ashamed to tell that we have done this for Swami, we have done this to Swami, because they always say, nothing we have done, it is Swami who has done to us. Please don't talk about this, don't embarrass us by saying we built this for Swami or we did this for Swami.
I mean, even now, if I don't know whether these farmers are still alive, but I mean, what a great opportunity it is if they come and see that, you know, here is a university which Swami has built and tens of thousands of children have benefited from this. You know, what would have been a piece of land which, you know, would have given them enough to feed only their family. Even that fulfillment, it cannot be actually measured by money. And that joy of, that is the other aspect of when you give something to the Lord, you know, He can make use of it much, much more than what you can make use of, whether it is your money or it is, you know, your own time, your own life. As youngsters, we've seen that, you know, you and I could have been anywhere doing anything. Probably would have, you know, done some silly work the whole week and then chilled out the weekend. Mm-hmm. That's all we could have done. And I mean, it's not that we have done something now. It's not to say in that sense. But doing what we would have anyway done, right? It's not like I have done something out of my capacity. The same 5 days a week or 6 days a week I would have worked elsewhere, I'm working here, but Swami is ensuring that that becomes, like as you said, the seed which is sown. It is being scattered to so many people and so many people are benefiting out of it. And that's the joy of giving. Even, you know, that 1 minute to infinity becomes infinite. But 1 minute kept to yourself is finite. That's all it is, and that's all it's worth is.
I think we have repeated this multiple times, but there is that poem from Gitanjali where Rabindranath Tagore writes in a very poetic manner about how this person is waiting to ask the emperor for something, and the emperor is coming in his golden chariot at the golden time of dusk. And when the emperor comes near him, instead of giving him an opportunity to ask what he wants, the emperor asks this man, what can you give me? And this person feels that, what is this? Are you mocking me? What is this that you're doing? But he has collected something for the day, and from his little bundle, he pulls out one piece of corn. He says that, I need the corn for fully filling my belly. Maybe one corn I'll give, because after all, it's the king asking. So he says he gives him one piece of corn. And that's all he offers to the emperor. The emperor rides away without giving him anything. And the poem goes on to say how at night, when he emptied his bag, among all the other belongings that were there in that, was one grain, one golden grain of corn. And at that time, that the person, the beggar or whoever he is, he just thinks, ah, how I wish I had given all my corn to him. That is what gets amplified when we are giving. It is a myth to say that we sacrifice for the Lord, because nobody sacrifices for the Lord, because the definition of sacrifice is you giving up something bigger for the sake of something smaller. But when you know that the most magnificent, the largest, the most absolute, biggest thing in the universe is God, whatever you give for His sake is definitely smaller than Him, then it is not a sacrifice. We are giving up something small for something greater. It is not a sacrifice, and that has been the experience of anybody who has had this opportunity, and we are grateful to Swami for that experience.
And it's really a beautiful experience. You know, we should be grateful to Hislop. In fact, I've never come across this before. We must have read this book, but it didn't strike us. But you know, now when you look at it, so much magnanimity in Swami, and you know, the reason behind it is so strong. Swami is also giving us that precept in that manner. After this, the discussion goes on into another important aspect of money when Hislop asks Swami, why is he doing this? But probably we'll take a quick break before that, and dear listeners, don't go away. We'll continue this discussion. I'm sure the points which Swami makes hereafter are also very, very important for us to keep in mind.
साई बिन रहा ना जाए साईं बिन रहा ना जाए हाय राम याद साईं
Welcome back, dear listeners. Our conversation here continues as the conversation between Hislop and Bhagwan continues. Swami continues to tell Hislop after the farmer's episode. Swami says, the 10 rupee note tells you that it has seen many faces and will see many more. Money comes to your hand but does not stay, whereas morality comes and stays. Money comes and goes, morality comes and grows. With many people, they are quite agreeable to misuse money for self-indulgence, for bad action. But if the possibility comes up to use the money for a good purpose, they at once become extremely cautious and reluctant and bring up many objections. This is, again, a very interesting observation which is so apt. that I think Swami had even exemplified this through his drama Cheppinatlu Chestara, wherein the father tells a needy boy that he doesn't have money to pay for his tuitions, but pays double the amount the moment a colleague comes and tells him that we need to plan a party at office. So it is like that. For us, what is important is so selfish in that sense, because we are so looking at it in that manner. I might be ready to feel that spending 2 lakh rupees for a pleasure trip is not a big deal, it's fine, we're going to have fun and all that, but to spend 2,000 or 3,000 rupees or give the maid servant an additional 200 rupees, I may feel that, will it be misused, does she deserve it? I mean, it goes through so much of I might finally end up giving, but it goes through so much of due diligence and thinking that when now we stand aside and look at it, it becomes evident that we are very, very selfish people, which Bhagwan is not. And that's why it's not such a big deal for him to just hand over 6 times the amount.
It reminds me of that beautiful movie that we happened to watch on Sant Tukaram, the most recent one in Marathi. Thanks to you, I went back and watched that. Very beautifully portrays that transformation that happens in Sant Tukaram, you know, where he experiences that famine, where he sees a number of people in his village die, number of people in his own family die. And that is when he realizes that, you know, it's so foolish to say that this is my money and I am lending it to you and you owe me this and, you know, we are bound like this. He gets so frustrated by all of these thinking, he goes and drowns all those records. He's actually a money lender. He drowns all the records of the people who are indebted to him, and he says,
opens up the granaries.
Right, and he says, all of you are free. And in a sense, it strikes him how much God gives without keeping a track on, you know, we're all alive, we're all having food to eat, we're all flourishing. We owe so much to God, and within that, we kind of grab as much as we can and say that this is mine, and then we lend it to somebody, or we say that you owe this to me, and, you know, he says it's also meaningless. And that's what the idea of, you know, when we want to give somebody, I mean, especially in the modern world today, if you go out to a mall, if you go out to a film, how easily we spend money. I mean, it's unbelievable how we are ready to loosen our purse and spend without thinking a moment. But as you said, if you want to help somebody, will this person make good use of the money? Does he really deserve this money? You know, even for 10 rupees or 15 rupees, we think so much. And that's clearly that mentality that, you know, when it comes for me, when it comes to my entertainment, my luxury, there is no limit. You know, I can spend as much as I want. Mm. But, you know, that change in attitude. You know, when Swami is talking here about this 10 rupees going from person to person, I'm sure we must have narrated this incident of what was narrated by one of the students from old Vrindavan, where apparently there was this Brahmin who had come from, I think East Godavari or one of these places. Mm. There was a huge flood in that particular year, 1971 or 74. Many of these villages were completely washed away, and this particular Brahmin person had lost all his property. He wanted to perform the Upanayanam for his son. Mm. And somebody had told him that, you know, Swami is there and Baba will help you. So he came all the way to Vrindavan to ask Swami to give him 2,000 rupees so that he can perform the Upanayanam of his son, so that the tradition doesn't stop. Right? So he came and, you know, he looked around. Somebody told him that, I think Lakshmi Narasimhan sir, who later became the registrar of a university, he was there. So somebody told him that he is very close to Swami. He goes into Swami's bungalow every day. So this Brahmin gentleman comes and requests Lakshmi Narasimhan sir, can you please tell Swami, I just need these 2,000 rupees to perform this, not for any other expense, only for this purpose I've come. Can you please tell Swami? And Lakshmi Narasimhan sir, anybody who has been true to Swami's proximity will know that you cannot mediate between a devotee and Swami. Hmm. And rightly so, he told this person, it's impossible, I might be with Swami the whole day, but I cannot go and tell Swami that this devotee wants this and then come and relay that reply to you. That is not possible. But he said, your prayer is genuine, so I will pray for you. You know, when I'm in Swami's presence, internally, mentally, I'll pray. You also pray here. Definitely Swami will come. You know, Swami is not a person who needs to be told physically. The true prayer will always reach Swami. Nevertheless, this Brahmin man was very disappointed that this person is not going to help him. And as promised, you know, Lakshmana Narasimhan sir was telling that when he was in Swami's presence, he prayed mentally to Swami.
Mm.
And Swami, this gentleman asked me like this, you know what is best? But, you know, I felt it was a genuine prayer that he was making. It would be nice if Swami helps him. So Swami didn't say anything. Swami did not talk to him. Swami goes out for darshan. And Swami comes back with a bunch of letters. And then Swami sits down. These boys were all around Swami in the safe room, right, in the old bungalow. So boys were sitting around Swami and Swami was sitting there and going through these letters. And then suddenly Swami started speaking about money. So Swami said, see, money is like water. As long as it is flowing, it will be fresh and it will be clean. The moment it starts stagnating, that's when it becomes unhealthy and becomes injurious to the person who is going to use it. And then Swami said, it has to keep flowing. Today it is with me, tomorrow it should be with you, and you should give it to somebody else. And that's the best way. You should keep rotating money. And then Swami said, see, I'll give you an example. Today when I came down, this Lakshmi Narasimhan, he was standing there, and he was praying for that Brahmin, right? Swami tells on his own.
Mm.
That he was praying for this Brahmin who had come to perform his son's Upanayanam. And Swami said, see, that Brahmin's prayer was genuine. Lakshmi Narasimhan's heart was also pure when he prayed for this. So Swami said, I desired to bless that devotee. So Swami said, I took in a cover 120 rupee notes. Swami said, okay, 100 crisp 20 rupee notes. I put in an envelope and I went out looking for this devotee. And Swami said, I found the devotee and I gave this money to him. And I mean, you can imagine the thrill of that devotee. We don't know the account of that devotee, but he must have been so thrilled that, you know, what a reinforcement of faith it must have been that you can sit and pray and God listens to you. You don't need people to carry your prayers to Swami. So Swami says, I went and gave him this envelope. He was very happy. See, what did I give that Brahmin man? Swami asked. And Swami said, I gave him 120 rupee notes. And Swami was like, as he was telling this whole thing, he was going through the bunch of letters in his hand. And he just picked out one envelope which was still not open. And Swami gave it to one of the boys and said, open it. And when that person opened it, they were exactly the same denomination of the money which Swami had given to that gentleman.
Hmm.
And in the same 20 or 100, whatever Swami told. Swami said, see, I gave 20 hundreds there and I got 20 hundreds here. Swami said, like this, money has to keep rotating.
Wow.
So beautiful experience, but a message, you know, that old student was narrating this. He said, it is so clear, you know, you've witnessed the whole thing happen in front of you and all of it, you know, you've seen grace, you've seen prayer, and you've seen a demonstration of what the message Swami is teaching also.
Absolutely. In fact, on some other occasion, Swami has also compared the flow of money to manure. Swami says, if manure is gathered in one particular place, it becomes a stinking heap. The same manure spread over a large area gives rise to growth,
fertility,
you know, fertility in the soil and crops. So too, money should not be gathered in the same area. He also says money is like blood. Blood needs to keep flowing to keep the body vital. Otherwise, it becomes a boil and becomes infected if it stagnates at one or clots at one particular place. At this point, Hislop takes the conversation onto a completely different note. He tells Swami, on the road to Simla, so reading that, I just feel it possibly is 1973, because, or I don't know after that when Swami went to Simla, but 1973 definitely Swami had visited North India and he had been to Simla. So maybe that. Hislop is saying, Swami, on the road to Simla, drivers were very reckless in trying to stay close behind Swami's car. At one moment, our car, which was going at a high speed, swerved to miss another car and was about to run down a policeman at the side of the car. It seemed sure there was neither time nor space to avoid striking him. But at the last second only, his uniform was brushed by the car and he was not harmed. Surely it must be Swami who is driving every devotee's car. Is it not? And Swami says, no. It is the driver's responsibility. He must exercise caution and responsibility. It is only at the moment of an accident that Swami takes over the situation.
Swami is so clear. I mean, it's a very important message for all of us, you know. Just because you're Swami's devotee, it does not absolve you of your duties, of
and
your responsibilities. You have to do what you have to do. And I mean, the simplest thing is, So it's like your teacher. You could have the best of teachers, but when you go for the exam, you have to write it. You know, even however kind-hearted the teacher is, however compassionate the teacher is, the teacher will not help you at the exam, because that becomes, you know, breach of the law. Same thing with Swami. He's saying what you have to do, you have to do. But, of course, the divine grace can always come in. And that is, again, Swami would tell, I think, in the one of the conversations we went through where Swami speaks about surrender, Swami meant that. You know, when you surrender to God, then it becomes a different equation altogether. But what duty has to be done, Swami so beautifully and categorically says here.
And he's saying only at that moment of accident that Swami will take over. See, we often do this, you know, to justify our own laziness or our own fear. I'm scared of doing something or I'm lazy to do something. At that point I tell, you know, because people ask, why do you blame me for the wrong that I do? Even a blade of grass doesn't move without God's will. So, I'm me doing bad must be God's will then. My reply to such people is, you doing a bad is God's will. Then tomorrow if somebody chops your neck and you die, take that as God's will with the same kind of equanimity.
And you know, somebody blaming you is also God's will. Why should you feel bad about that?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So we shift between the levels wherein when it comes to the things that I don't like, I say it's all, after all, God's will. But when it comes to other things, I would like to take credit. I would like to have the glory and bask in it. And this kind of hypocrisy is so subtle but existent in all of us, you know, even in our prayers. For instance, like when somebody says, I just wish this happens, I wish that happens, and it's all based on problems that I'm facing in my life. I'm so focused only on that. As you said, you know, when we start thinking broader, when we start looking at the earth, the universe, the galaxy, you know, we realize how tiny we are, how small our problems are, but we don't do that. And it's because of that selfish vision, our problems look big, you know. Like I would say, Swami, this is such a big problem, please, you must solve it. What if Swami tells me, my child, what's happening in Yemen is a much bigger problem. Let me sort that, then I'll come to you. You know, I realize what it is. And what am I doing about the problem in Yemen? I don't contribute anything to solving any problem. I'm only obsessed and focused with my own problems. And when it comes to problems, say in Yemen or any, I just took up Yemen, but any other kind of problem when somebody brings it, I say that, oh, I don't know what I can do. I'll just pray to the Lord. You know, Swami will take care. Samasta Loka. And the funny thing is, I'm ready to entrust the Lord with such global problems. You know, the crisis in Yemen. I have no idea what to do, but Swami will take care. I'll pray to him. But Swami, when it comes to my education or my career or my relationship, I don't think you can handle it, Swami. I know better. You know, it is absolute selfishness, because I don't try to think, what can I do sitting here? How can I help? How can I help people in Africa, or how can I help those people affected by the earthquake or the flood? I just say, no, this is little what I can do. Rest. Ah, Swami will take care. God will take care. I'll pray. But when it's my own life, I feel God doesn't have the wisdom. God, you are good at taking care of the world, but my life, you don't know. This is the kind of double talk we do. This is the kind of hypocrisy. And possibly we are doing it very unconsciously. This is a time when we can become aware of it and try to correct it. I'm not saying that we are all hypocrites and we are doing it wantonly. But having recognized this, you know, and we recognize it when we see such examples being given here. It's like I drive recklessly and tell, Swami, you're in charge of everybody's life, so you take care, you're responsible for the accident. I'm reminded of a parable from Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, where he would narrate of how a man is walking, how a guru tells his disciple that everyone is divine. And as the man is walking on the road, there's a rogue elephant, which has gone out of the control of the mahout. And the mahout is running crazily behind the elephant, but the elephant is just rushing and destroying everything in its wake. This disciple decides that after all there's divinity in everything, so he stands and the elephant harms him actually, hits him and he's injured. He goes back to his guru and tells, Guru, your teaching is not working. You said divinity is in all, but yet that elephant hurt me. And the guru tells, yes, divinity is in all. Wasn't that mahout shouting, get out of the way? Why didn't you heed to the divinity in the mahout? So we do all this convenient philosophy interpretation based on our convenience and our selfishness, and later on find faults in the universal laws and universal love, which is God. So I think incidents like this or conversations like this wake us up to this subtle hypocrisy that we indulge in possibly on a daily basis, so that we can be more aware and, you know, try to start putting efforts to stop ourselves from doing this.
Well, it always happens as long as you have one option as being more, conducive than the other one. And otherwise, as we have, whenever we speak about surrender, we say that, being saved from an accident is an act of God. Being involved in an accident is also an act of God. Mm. If that was not meant to be, Swami will not let you go through that. And that is surrender. That's what Swami would say. Surrender is not about giving up all responsibility of action, or surrender is not about saying that Swami will take care. Surrender is about believing that whatever is happening is perfect. As he said, if that policeman was hit, and you say that was God's grace, as one of our former superintendents of the general hospital used to say. Apparently, he would come and report to Swami every week or whatever about the patients. He would say, Swami, this patient was fine by Swami's grace. This patient is all right now by Swami's grace. And three patients died by Swami's grace. Right? And because he really meant it. He said, that is the best thing for that soul. Because after coming to Swami's hospital, if that's what has happened to that person, that's also Swami's grace. And that is the surrender that Swami is talking of. But as long as we have one option, which is more like in that case of that person who's saying that elephant is also God, he wouldn't be asking that question to God if you feel that living was more better than dying. Otherwise, you would have said, okay, elephant killed me, God killed me, and God, took away the life which he gave. Mm-hmm. But we are not in that state. So either you go towards that surrender, or the surrender of what Swami would say, surrender in action, which means you do the action as when you're doing it, thinking that this is my responsibility, use all your faculty and do it, like we spoke about when you're talking about watch your action. That's what it is. It is yoga, karma, su, kaushalam is also part of surrender that we oftentimes forget.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take another little break, because this interview, it looks like it's not following one particular stream of thoughts. At each point, there is a different theme coming up, and each one is equally interesting. So we'll take up the next theme after this little break.
Thank you. ప్రేమ స్వరూపులారా. నా పిల్లల యొక్క పరిస్థితి నాకు తెలుసు, కానీ మరొకరు తెలియదు. నేను ఎప్పుడు మీ వెంటనే జంటనే ఇంటనే ఉంటుంటాను. మీరందరూ కూడా ఐకమత్యంతో పనిచేయండి.
Work with a feeling of unity.
నా సీట్ ఇక్కడ కాదు.
Bhagwan's seat is not here.
నా సీట్ మీ హృదయమే.
Bhagwan's chair is your heart.
కనుకనే మీరు ఎక్కడ ఉంటే అక్కడ కూడా స్వామి ఉంటున్నాడు.
స్వామి ఇస్ దేర్ వెరెవర్ యు ఆర్.
ఏ కొరతలు మీకు జరగవు.
నథింగ్ విల్ హ్యాపెన్ టు యు.
ఏ విధమైనటువంటి అపజయాలు మీకు జరగవు.
యు విల్ నెవర్ హావ్ ఫెయిల్యూర్.
కానీ పరిపూర్ణమైన విశ్వాసంతో మీరు పనులు ప్రారంభించండి.
వర్క్ విత్ టోటల్ ఫెయిత్.
ఏ పని చేసినా కూడా ఇది భగవత్ కార్యంగా భావించండి.
వాట్ ఎవర్ యూ మే డూ గుడ్ వర్క్ టేక్ ఇట్ ఎస్ గాడ్స్ వర్క్.
Welcome back, dear listeners. I wonder how many of you guessed what song that is. I'm sure most of you would have. Well, if you did guess it, do let us know what song it is, because it's for a reason that we played that instrumental. Watch out our website for the next 2 days. We are having a beautiful article about the history of that particular song that we played. And it's a very, very moving story. And it's a song which is very important for Swami's students, and of course so many devotees connect to Swami through that song. So if you know what song it is, do let us know. We'll see if you've guessed it right, and even otherwise check Radio Sai website in the next 2 days for a short history of that song.
I think Prem, you're going to get a flood of answers, because this song is so close to the hearts of millions of devotees across the globe, and especially as a student, the way we resonate with the song, how many times have we not cried along with our singing of this song? And it's so amazing and beautiful also to discover that, you know, whenever we say that we are yearning for the Lord, we are pining for God, we are seeking God, Swami tells that God is seeking and pining and yearning for a devotee with much greater intensity than the devotee is doing it. And this song actually made us visualize that, because we have seen Swami himself shedding tears and himself joining in singing this song. So it's really a beautiful song. It has such a rich history. We are grateful to all the alumni brothers and sisters from across the world who have actually contributed their might in helping us document the history of the song. So yes, Prem, even I am eagerly looking forward to the release of this article along with the associated audio and visual.
And it's timely because of the season also.
Yes, in a few days from now, we'll be having the alumni meet. The 31st of December, the alumni of the Sri Sat Sai Primary School will be meeting.
And then 30th, the Music College.
The Music College alumni, yes. The recent most addition to the educational institutions. And on 1st, of course, the university students, alumni. So it is in flavor, and we are very excited at Radio Sai to present this. So do watch out our website for this article.
And let's go back to this conversation. As Arvind just mentioned before we took that short break, a lot of themes are being discussed in this one particular conversation which is happening. Initially it started with Swami speaking about money, Swami speaking about charity, giving a hint about that. And then this particular conversation where Swami speaks about surrender, drivers and driving on hilly ghat roads in Shimla. Right? I mean, one thing is the skill of some of these drivers who drive on these roads. Earlier this year, I was in, think this year or last year. I think this year some of us had been to Sikkim, and the roads there, my God, and that person can drive on such roads half asleep.
You know, Prem, phenomenal. Actually, when I read this, that is one thought came that Hislop, you thought he's going to do an accident.
Hislop has no idea about the skill of the driver.
For him, it was like, this is normal. Yeah, I knew it all the while that I'm not going to hit that policeman.
Right. He must have been very confident. And it must have been his skill. And, you know, as Swami was saying, that it's the duty of the driver. I'm sure he must have done his duty. And that's the confidence that Swami is saying, that in spite of it, if an accident happens, be sure I will be there to save it.
Perspective. Right? Perspective is everything. and that's what possibly comes to the fore even in the next question. Because Hislop asks, why does Swami conduct a marriage ceremony for older people who are long married? This concept, which I think we call it as Shashtyabdi Purti or Shashti Purti for short. I'm sure for a person who is not acquainted with the Bharatiya culture and philosophy, it really seems strange. You know, usually when the husband turns 60, they do this second marriage. What is the need for performing a marriage when they have lived together so much? In modern day world, definitely it calls for a celebration when the husband turns 60, because a marriage has lasted that long. Nowadays, it has become an amazing thing, a matter of celebration, where if people are together for 5 years or 10 years. But I think that was a norm, and even when we were children, we took it for granted that once a marriage is done, they're married for life. That's how we have been taking it. It's only a very, very recent phenomenon, at least in India, where you think that remaining married for some time is an amazing thing, and you need to celebrate it and all that. But yes, to conduct a marriage ceremony, and it is done with elaborate rituals, right. Great ritual. So it is natural that Hislop gets this question, and Swami gives the answer. Swami says, in India, at age 60, people have a second marriage as rebirth of the marriage into spiritual life, directed towards God and not concerned with the senses. Prior to age 60, the couple were entitled to enjoy the fruits of the senses. At the age of 70, 7 also has a significance. There are 7 great rishis, that is the Sapta rishis. And at age 70, a person should be merged with these saints. At age 80, there are 8 deities reigning over the directions. They are called the Ashtadikpalakas. At age 80, we should be merged with these deities. At age 90, there are 9 special planets, the Navagrahas, and we should be merged with them. At age 100, one should be master of the 5 working organs, that is the Karmendriyas, and the 5 sense organs, and or the Jnanendriyas, and should be merged with God. The 5 working organs are talking, walking, rejection, which is excrement, procreating and eating. The 5 sense organs are hearing, touch, sight, taste and smell. So this is the explanation Swami gives to Hislop.
And when I was reading this, I was reminded of a beautiful talk by Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram, where she explains how an experience or a conversation which spanned over many, many years, where she said the first time when she was 20, when she went up to Swami and said, Swami, it's my birthday, and you know, Swami, bless me, because we consider 20 as a important landmark in our life, especially when you're only 20. 20 is a huge landmark, right?
Yes.
When you're 60, you might think that 20 is nothing, but when you just crossed,
got out
teens,
of your teenage,
right,
huh?
you feel like you've become a really elderly person now. So when she went up to Swami and said, Swami, it's my 20th birthday, and Swami asked her, what is the significance of 20? You know, in the spiritual journey, what should you mark your 20th birthday with? And she said, Swami, I don't know. Swami said, see, 20, the important number is 2. Right? You remove the 0, it's 2. So Swami said, by 20th birthday, you should have mastered Shraddha and Saburi. Swami said, you should have these 2 virtues of steadfastness and patience, or faith and patience, however you'd like to look at it. And she said, okay, Swami. And then this fast forwards 10 years, and when she was celebrating her 30th birthday, she came to Swami and said, Swami, it's my 30th birthday. And Swami said, what is the significance of 30? So if it's 30, what you should have mastered by then? And Swami said, you should have mastered purity in thought, word, and deed. Unity and purity of thought, word, and deed.
Trikarna Shuddhi.
Trikarna Shuddhi. And Swami said, that's the importance of the 30th birthday. And by the time she was 40, I think she'd shifted to United States, and she came for her birthday at that time. And again, Swami said, do you remember what I told you for 20 and 30? What is it for 40? Swami asked. And she said, Swami, I don't know. Swami said, you should have perfected living in sync with dharma, artha, kama and moksha.
The four purusharthas.
And then again, when she turned 50, Swami again asked her. I think whether it was on her 50th birthday or on 40th, Swami kind of gave for the rest of the thing, saying that, you know, ensure that you follow all of this. So at 5, Swami said, you know, it's the you should live in harmony with the panchabhutas, I think. You should have attained complete control over your 5 senses by the time you turn 50. And then Swami said, you know, when you turn 60, you should have had completely removed the Arshadvargas. And then, of course, the 70, 80, 90, 100, what Swami told here, Swami had explained to her. You know, at 7, you should have become one with the Saptarishis. At 70, you should have become one with the Saptarishis. At 80, you should become like the Ashtadik Balakas. At 90, you should have...
One with the Navagrahas.
You should have elevated yourself to the state of the Navagrahas, that much purity. And by 100, you should have become one with God. There should not be any difference at all.
So much catching up to do, Prem. I am approaching 40 and...
Absolutely. Tikarna Shuddhi is...
We are supposed to
backlog.
Yes.
And Shraddha and Saburi, as though we have managed that.
We've got a little bit... Yeah. That's why I think I feel young, Prem. I feel like I'm a teenager still.
Immature.
From a spiritual parlance, yes, definitely kiddo. One thing that is very interesting here, Prem, I see, is this concept of expansion as we age. Swami always says, have expansion love, or expansion is life. I still wonder, what is this expansion? Because when I look at myself from my teenage years to now, I have definitely expanded. And that's not the way I would like to expand in my width or breadth. But Swami keeps talking of expansion, and I think it is the expansion of vision. When you say from Saptarishi, Saptarishi is supposed to be like the perfect among the beings. You are possibly the, like a Purushottama. You are like a very ideal human being. But even that is not enough, because Swami says you have to go to the level of the Ashtadikpalakas. Ashtadikpalakas, the lords of the eight directions, they actually hold, they support the earth. And when they say support the earth, it's not just about humans, it's about nature, it's about animals, it's about everything that this world is about. So there you see a level of expansion. And then you have to become the Navagrahas, meaning the Navagrahas is not just concerned about the earth, it's about the entire solar system, if you see that way. So you're going on becoming bigger and bigger, and your purview is becoming bigger. And the same is seen even when we look at life from an ashrama dharma point of view. You know, it begins with Brahmacharya Ashram, where it is supposed to be the time for education and building the foundation for life. In Brahmacharya Ashram, possibly the focus of your life is just yourself, your sustenance, how you build, how you live, how you learn, what you pick up, what is the foundation of your life, and all, only that, you. From Brahmacharya, you move to Grihastha, it's no longer you. You have to think about yourself, your family, your children, your parents. Because possibly as children, we never think of our parents. We may think of parents in an emotional manner, but we don't support them. We depend on them for everything. Right. It's when we reach Grahastha stage that we have to take care of one generation above, or two generations above, and one generation below, definitely. And as we move from Grahastha to Vanaprastha, now we become possibly like grandparents. You have got generations above, you have got generations below, and you are like an elder in the family and the extended family everywhere. You have to have everybody's welfare in mind. So automatically you're growing in your love, which was restricted only to you, then grew only to your nuclear family, now is to your extended family.
Sometimes, you know, Vanaprastha is spoken of as the period when you give back to society in terms of your wisdom. Right? I mean, you've graduated from that active part of life, but you don't straight away go off to sannyasa. You remain in the society for some time, where you give back in the form of wisdom to the people around. As you were saying, that expansion of to the entire village or to the community where you are living in is what is the role when you come to Vanaprastha.
And sannyasis, though they're absolutely detached, they bear the responsibility of the welfare of the entire world. And the way Swami has explained here for 70s, 80s, 90s, I just feel it's an elaboration of the Vanaprastha and Sannyasa stage itself.
Right.
To show how you have to grow from caring for your society, caring for your country, to caring for the entire world, to caring for the entire world, not only in terms of humans, but also for the animals, the plants, the living beings, everything. Finally, you care for the entire system, the entire universe, and that is how you become one with God, because God is the ultimate and infinite expansion. So we begin our the moment we are born, we have to start growing, expanding to reach this level. And in that sense, Swami says that the Shashtabdi Purti, or the marriage that is performed at the 60th birthday, marks the entry possibly into the Vanaprastha Ashram. It reminds us that till now we have traveled as a couple in the worldly journey, enjoying the senses. From now it is time to go beyond the senses, and we shall do that too as a couple. So that is the significance of the marriage that is performed when a couple turn 60.
Right, and that is the significance of the Grihastha Ashrama. You know, it is a very, very important aspect of spiritual life. And the reason why Swami would often explain that, why we get lost in this ashrama, and why, you know, the popular belief that to become spiritual you need to be detached from family and you should take sannyasa early. That idea has come because of the over involvement in the Grihastha Ashrama. And that's why Swami would say that 60th, that marriage which is performed when a person turns 60, is a very important significance. In fact, we've seen Swami performing that for so many people. Talking about Swami performing it for Indian couple, Swami did that for Walter Cowan,
yes.
After he was resurrected, and Swami performed the Bhimarata Shanti, I think that's performed
for 70.
70, when somebody turned 70, and Swami did it in an elaborate manner during Swami's 80th birthday, right? If I'm not wrong.
Yes,
as a run up 80th birthday. So Swami performed it for almost 80 couples or something like that. Swami had performed all those people who have served Swami for so many years. These are reminders that, you know, catch up. You know, you cannot be still focused only on your family, only on your children, only on the welfare of, you know, how am I going to pass on this property? Will my son run the company the way I've run it? You're supposed to give up all of these things, because that is when you get caught up. Grihastha Ashrama as such is not going to entangle you or become an impedance to your spiritual progress. But when you get lost in that, you know, you constantly keep seeing in the news of 70-year-old people getting married, 60-year-old people getting married for the first time, you know, or remarrying after the divorce.
And 70-year-old marrying 17-year-old.
Right.
Means a Vanaprastha ashram marrying the Brahmacharya ashram. I mean, all these circus going on.
Right. You know, that is why as long as the goal is always spiritual, nothing on the path will become an obstacle. It will only help you progress, you know, on your path. Education and career or your family, all of that will only help you. But once the vision is wrong, you know, if your focus is wrong, you can lead a sannyasi's life, you can lead a brahmachari's life, you can become, wear an ochre robe. That's what Swami says in one of his Telugu songs. He says, Donga sannyasulaku duramavutuve. As a goal, God will become far from those who fake these kind of, you know, emotions.
Detachment and all that.
Rather than doing it truly.
So, you know, even as you said about property and will and all that, actually if you see in what they call it in modern parlance as life stage management and all that, one of the first things is as you start crossing 50, nearing your 60, they start telling you to prepare, you know, your will, you keep it. It's good to have a will prepared. I mean, you and I, we may not have our will prepared as of now. But even as people approach 60, they're advised by their financial advisors that it's time possibly to draw up a will. You may be healthy and everything, but it's good. I feel the world today has moved to a stage where when it comes to physical assets and properties, there are a lot of good advice. There's a lot of good advice and a lot of good advisors who tell all these. But we restrict it only at the level of the body. What about the mind and the soul? Who will help in planning for that? The other journeys that the mind and soul go through. And that is what Swami does for us. That is what Swami has come to give here. As you rightly said, you know, once you reach a certain stage, we see when it comes to, I'm speaking about Indian women, I've observed it in my grandmother, I'm seeing it in my mother, you know, as they start crossing 60, see, slowly their jewelry, they'll give up. What do I need so much jewelry for? Give it to their daughters or granddaughters, or, you know, start. And the same thing happens, you know, start distributing your property, your assets, you divide, and basically that itself shows a shift, how you have become large-hearted, you know, from keeping everything for yourself, you have started to give it off, you know, to possibly to family, and sometimes you see in will, different people even donate it off to organizations, all that happens. So while you're growing larger in terms of materialistic sense, you also have to grow larger and expand in the spiritual and mental sense, and that is what, that is why I think all these rituals are also created, you know. For 60 we have Shashtyabdi Purti, for 70 we have Bhima Ratha Shanti, for 80 we have something called the Sahasra Purna Chandra Darshana, meaning when that, by the time you have turned 80, you have actually witnessed 1,000 full moons in your life. And in fact they requested, and Swami was gracious enough to bless us all with allowing that Sahasra Chandra Darshanam to be performed for Bhagwan himself. Then for 90 there's a ceremony. So for 100 there's a ceremony. So all these rituals become very important as long as we remember the spirit behind it. That's why Swami says it is the spirit behind the ritual that makes it spiritual. If we forget the spirit, the ritual is of no use. But that should not be an excuse for us to, you know, speak low or, you know, downplay the importance of rituals. In fact, the next question is exactly that, but I don't know if we'll have time to go into that, because there's an Indian visitor who is asking, these Hindu rites and rituals, is there anything in anything to them? You know? He is asking this to Swami, and Swami gives a very beautiful answer. But as I said, the time in our studios is already 1:57, which tells us that it's time to wrap up. So, dear listeners, we will possibly take up this question the next week during the next segment of this Conversations with Sai. We hope that you enjoyed this. You can definitely contribute with your thoughts and ideas by writing in to listener@radiosai.org. On that note, we offer the segment at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet, and we will play a song for you, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ma, Priyamaina Bandhama, Prema Kurupama, Mandari Pranama, O Sai Ma. ప్రతీక్షణం నీతో నిగడపాలని గడిచే ప్రతీక్షణం నీతో నిగడపాలని మేము వినే పదాలన్నీ మాటలు కావాలని గడిచే ప్రతీక్షణం నీతో నిగడపాలని మేము వినే పదాలన్నీ నీ మాటలే కావాలని మాలోని తా
Listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.